Good morning, all. This is Arne Hackett in Raleigh. Today we have Mr. Mike Fitzpatrick of the Design and Strategy Department, who's going to take us through the ZOS communication server performance improvements. And with that, I'll let Mike take it away.
All right. Thanks, Arne. Yeah, as Arne mentioned, what we're going to talk about today is some of the performance improvements we've done in the past few releases for ZOS communication server. Specifically, we're going to focus in on how we communicate with the OS Express adapter. So we will jump to slide 3, where we'll talk about the agenda. Basically, what we're going to discover or talk about first is, in terms of TCP/IP performance over OS Express, the most important thing is how we can manage the processing of inbound packets. We'll show that there's trade-offs between either getting, you know, very good latency or very good CPU utilization, being able to handle interrupts off of the OSA. So we'll talk about some of the inbound path optimizations we have done starting, you know, way back quite a few releases ago, and show how we've marched towards our latest improvements. We'll also talk about outbound packet processing. You know, most of our focus here today will be on inbound, but there are some outbound optimizations that we have also worked on. And finally, we'll just give you kind of a peek at some of our preliminary numbers that we've done for OS Express 4, which was available with the GA2 version of the 196. So let's start off then with inbound optimization. So what we have here on slide 5, this is really the TCP/IP stack layer. At the bottom, we have the devices. We have a device driver that then receives the interrupt and receives the data from the device and passes it up to the TCP/IP stack, which goes through our interface layer, our IP layer, and actually up to the transport layer, where it can then go and talk to the application. So what the most important piece of this inbound flow is really the communication between the OS Express or the interface and the inbound device driver. So what we're going to talk about is there's predominantly two different types of traffic patterns that you normally will see, and we'll go through each of them in the next slide on slide 6. So the first type of workload that we typically see into ZOS is, we call them inbound streaming. It's a bulk data transfer, an FTP inbound transfer, or something like that. What you will normally see is when a bulk transfer occurs, the application is going to be sending a large file. You know, it'll send 180K worth of data in one send. Obviously, we can't send that 180K across a network in one full swoop because of factors such as MTU. So we actually will segment that packet, that large buffer, into smaller segments, and then send all of them. So it's basically what it looks like coming into the OSA then is a stream of data. It's a stream of IP packets. And they are tightly spaced together because basically we sent them in, from the one endpoint all together, and they come in one after another coming into the OSA. Obviously, we do not want to interrupt every packet, you know, have the OSA interrupt the operating system for every packet, because the amount of CPU overhead would be pretty large. So what we do is we have this concept in the OS Express 3 as well in the OS Express 4 of a LAN idle timer. Essentially what that is the OS Express will not interrupt the operating system until it sees a certain gap in the stream of packets coming in. So in our scenario here, suppose we have a LAN idle time of 20 microseconds. So as long as packets are coming in closely spaced together, the OS Express will not interrupt us. Once it detects that there is a gap, it will then interrupt the TCP/IP or the device layer with all of these packets that it gathered in. Obviously, you know, it doesn't wait forever for this gap to happen. There is another timer that's basically how long it will possibly keep gathering information before presenting the interrupt. But typically what you will see is these gaps, and OSA at that point will interrupt us. So in this scenario here, obviously we're going to get good CPU utilization, because within a single interrupt we can present a lot of packets. But now the other data pattern is interactive traffic. This is your web traffic, your TN3270 traffic. That is typically, we call it chatty traffic or interactive. You get a request and a response comes back. In this case, you do not want it would not be optimal to wait for 20 microseconds once that first single packet came in, waiting for another packet, because chances are there's not going to be another packet coming in. So we're basically would wait 20 microseconds before we presented that up, and then the response can come back. So ideally, what you'd want in this case is you'd want your lay and idle time to be as low as possible, down to, say, a microsecond. So in that case, when that single packet comes in, we can interrupt immediately, and then we can actually have that packet get processed by the application and the response get sent back out. So we could reduce our latency. But obviously, there's a trade-off there where you're going to have a little additional CPU because we're interrupting on every packet. But for an interactive traffic pattern, that's what you want to do because the goal is to reduce our latency. So on slide 7, then, this is basically with the lay and idle timer, we have a balancing act all the time. For interactive traffic, you obviously want to lower the lay and idle time because you can reduce your latency. But if you have streaming traffic, what do you want to do? You don't want to have that lower lay and idle time. You don't really care about latency as much with streaming traffic. What you really are more concerned with is the frequency of interrupts. So you want to save queue cycles, and we do that by increasing the lay and idle time.
Got you. Here we go.
So that is the basically the balancing act that we have with interactive traffic. All right. So on slide 8, then, you have the ability to set the lay and idle timer prior to ZOS V1R9. We had three settings for the lay and idle time that you could configure on the interface statement or the linking statement. It was called this INB perf, bound performance. The default is balanced, which basically strikes a medium between, so that if you have a mixed workload, it strikes a medium for the lay and idle time, so it's kind of an average time, but it's a static value. We also have min CPU, which basically, if this interface you know is only going to be processing interactive traffic, I'm sorry, if it's only going to be processing streaming traffic, you want min CPU, which basically says we're going to have a static interrupt value for the lay and idle timer, which is very large, which says we'll get fewer interrupts, but we'll be able to conserve CPU. And conversely, if you have an interface that's predominantly receiving interactive traffic, you may want the min latency setting, which is a static value that has a lot lower lay and idle timer, so you're getting interrupted more frequently, which reduces your latency. So those are the values prior to V1R9 are static values. But the problem is if you have throughout a workday, you may have different types of patterns of traffic throughout the day. So a static value really doesn't help you. So what we've done in V1R9 is this concept of a dynamic lay and idle timer. What we do in this case is we'll actually monitor the traffic that's coming in off at OSA. And if we detect that it looks like there's a lot of data coming in, so it's like a streaming type of workload, we'll actually adjust the dynamic lay and idle timer in the OSA so that it blocks more packets so that it will interrupt us less frequently. Then later on, for example, suppose that streaming traffic goes away and all you have now is interactive traffic, we'll detect that and we'll actually signal the OSA to reduce the lay and idle time so that it will start interrupting more frequently, so that we can actually reduce the latency of the interactive workloads.
So is that basically the recommended setting?
That is the recommended setting. So if you go to slide 10, even though the default is still balanced, because we try not to change defaults between releases if we can help it, we do recommend that the setting should be dynamic, because what we'll do is we'll give you the best of both worlds. If we detect that there's bulk workloads, we're going to basically reduce interrupt frequency, and if we detect just interactive, we'll try to reduce your latency. All right, so that's how you configure it now is on on your interface statement, you can configure a new. All right, so going to slide 11 then, so we'd have this now, this dynamic lay and idle timer. So it works very well when you have interactive traffic, we'll detect that, and then when you have streaming traffic, we'll detect that as well and adjust the dynamic lay and idle timer. The issue with the dynamic lay and idle timer is what happens if you have mixed workloads going on at the same time, which is probably typically the case, especially now with the larger 10 gig adapters, you can push a lot more different types of workloads onto that OSA. So what happens then in a mixed workload scenario is, in this scenario here, we have two different connections. We have a streaming connection going on as well as an interactive connection. Because we are detecting, we'll detect that it looks like there's a lot of data coming in, that's a streaming type of data pattern coming in, we're going to set our dynamic LAN idle time high to reduce the frequency of interrupts. Obviously, this is going to have a negative effect on our interactive connection because it's going to incur additional latency before that packet is actually able to be delivered from the OSA to the device. So in a mixed type of workload, dynamic LAN idle timer typically will default, will drop down to conserving CPU, which basically minimizes interrupts, which can increase your latency on some interactive connections. But as you'll see in subsequent releases, we've been able to address this as well. So on slide 12, this is how we addressed it, and this is back, this, we did this in V1R12. We have this concept of inbound workload queuing. Essentially what this is you have your single OSA device, but within that OSA now, we'll actually have different queues for the different types of traffic. So previously, from this picture here, previously we only had the default queue, and all workloads, all different types of network patterns went into that default queue. So what that meant is whatever your dynamic LAN idle timer was set to, it would only apply to that one queue. Now with this inbound workload queuing, what we're able to do is we can have multiple queues, and each one has its own LAN idle timer. And the two queues that, additional queues that we've made available in V1R12, one of them is a Sysplex distributor queue. Essentially what that is if your ZOS host is a Sysplex distributor node where it is receiving all the inbound packets and then distributes them to a target, you can have the OSA we can supply to OSA its own queue. So only Sysplex distributor traffic goes onto that queue, and we can process that outside of all the other workloads going in on that OSA. In addition, we have a streaming or a bulk queue. And on this bulk queue, what happens is all data that is any type of FTP or streaming type of data, all of that will go on that queue. And the dynamic LAN idle timer will be adjusted for that one. And obviously, if it's a streaming, the dynamic LAN idle timer will be very high, so that we reduce the frequency of interrupts. And what's left over is really our other workloads, which is our interactive workloads, and that will remain on the default queue. But now, since there's no streaming workload mixed in with it, our dynamic LAN idle timer can be dropped substantially because we know it's just interactive traffic, and now our interactive connections can achieve lower latency as well. So the other thing, what it does is because now the OSA is generating a different interrupt for each type of different data traffic, what we do, and we'll show you in the next slide, is we can actually now take advantage of some other optimizations for streaming traffic. Essentially, what we can do is, if we go to the next slide on 13, what we have, especially with multiprocessor configurations, which most people run with now, you have the chance of getting data delivered out of order. And it really shows up for streaming traffic. So in this example here, I have four connections worth of data that arrives on interrupt one that is running on SRB1 on general CP0. So you can see I have packets for B, some packets for connection C, some packets for connection D, and finally some packets for connection A. A little bit later, a second interrupt happens, and now I have same connections worth for four connections have data, but the packets for connection A are arriving first. So since we're on a multiprocessor environment, we can handle both of these interrupts simultaneously. The way the processing works in TCP/IP is we handle all the packets for connection B, then we handle them for C, then for D, and finally for A on interrupt one. And on interrupt two, we're going to handle the packets for connection A first. So as you can see, as we're handling the packets for connection A on SRB2, it is happening before we were able to process the packets on the previous interrupt. So what that means is those four packets for connection A are arriving before the two packets that were in the other interrupt, which means that they are out of order. Out of order processing for the TCP protocol is expensive. Essentially, what we have to do is, first of all, we have to queue these out of order packets on a side queue waiting for these other two packets to arrive. In addition, depending on how many of these packets arrive out of order, we may have to send an acknowledgement to the other side asking them to send us those two packets again because we think they may be lost. And in this scenario, they're not lost, but since they appear to be lost to us because of how many packets we're receiving after it, it will cause additional overhead on the client to have to retransmit that packet as well as additional processing on our end to handle the duplicate packets. So out-of-order processing can be expensive, and it can cut down on your throughput as well. So what we've done now, because of with this inbound workload queuing, since all the interrupts for the streaming traffic is on its own interrupt, what we are doing now is we are serializing the interrupts for streaming traffic, which means that we will use that same interrupt to handle all the packets coming in off of that inbound, off of that bulk queue. So that way we can guarantee in-order delivery up to the applications, which will get rid of our in-out-of-order problem, get rid of our any types of throughput issues we may have because we have to handle that out-of-order scenario. You'll see in some later charts we have some performance numbers that actually show you the benefit of doing this. So not only does IWQ, the inbound workload queuing, get us to remove the that bulk traffic off of the interactive queue, we also are able to take advantage to other optimizations to improve our out-of-order problems. So on slide 14, how does this get configured? On same statement, the inbound perf, INB perf statement on the interface statement, on the dynamic keyword, you can either specify no workload queuing, which is the default, or workload queuing, which will give you the advantage of this inbound workload queue support. One key thing here is this new keyword, it is only available on the interface statement. If you currently use device and link statement, you cannot use this new inbound perf keyword. But a couple releases ago, we provided support for the interface statement for IPv4 devices as well. So it would just be a matter of converting any existing device link statements for your OSA to use the interface statement for IPv4 traffic. All right, so how do you tell that inbound workload queuing is in effect? We have this new display command, OSA info, and it will actually tell you the different types of queues that are currently being used and what connections or IP addresses are registered to it. Now, this is how we determine if you have both the sysplex queue, the bulk queue, and the default queue. This is how we determine which queue to put these connections on. Obviously, if you have a dynamic or distributable device but defined on your system, we will register that IP address to the OSA to put it on its sysplex distributor queue, which means that any inbound packets that come in that are destined to doubt one of those IP addresses, which is the distributable device, the OSA will put it on that sysplex distributor queue, and interrupts will be handled from that specific queue. For bulk data, it's a little bit trickier. For bulk data, it is actually a five-tuple. It is the source and destination IP addresses, the port numbers, as well as the protocol to determine what gets registered on the bulk data queue. And the way this works is TCP/IP, we have enhancements in our TCP layer where when we detect that this new connection that was established looks like it's a streaming connection, and the way we detect that is if there's a lot of data going one direction and not the other direction, that to us is a streaming type of connection. What we will do is we will register that connection to the OSA so that any subsequent data packets that arrive in on it, it will get put onto this bulk data queue and it will be processed on its own interrupt outside of the default queue. Any other workloads or connections that do not meet these two criteria will fall into the default queue. Now, in this display here, obviously, we're just showing IPv6, but obviously this is supported on both IPv4 and IPv6. We can also determine whether workload queuing is in effect for the specific interface using the netstat devlinks command. There will actually display what type of inbound perf setting as well as whether workload queuing is enabled or not. The other thing you'll see is you can do a display net TRLE for the specific TRLE name that you define for your QDIO device, and in there we'll actually show you whether or not inbound workload queuing was enabled and the different queues that were enabled. Finally, you can do a netstat all command or for the specific connection. For example, this would be an FTP connection. You will see whether or not this specific connection was registered to the bulk data queue, and in this case, it is. There's also a netstat statistics display. Today, that shows the number of segments received. We'll actually break that out to show the number of segments of that total number of segments received, how many of those were received on the OSA bulk queues versus the default queue. All right, so a couple of quick summary review of inbound perf before we go to the next topic is prior to V1R9, we just had the three default settings, and the balance mode was the default and recommended setting because it was basically the best of both worlds, but it still didn't give you optimal performance depending on if your workload shifted from purely interactive to purely streaming workload. So we do recommend that you specify the inbound perf dynamic setting so that it self-tunes depending on what the network traffic is happening at that time. For mixed workloads, what we were able to do in V1R12 is introduce the inbound workload queuing function, which basically now allows you to separate the workloads so you no longer have mixed workloads, which means we can apply dynamic LAN functions to each of those queues independently so that streaming data will not affect the LAN idle timer for the interactive traffic. So now there's one other topic that for inbound OSA performance that I wanted to talk about. This is called optimized latency mode. So what is optimized latency mode? This is really was introduced in V1R11, and it really is only intended for workloads where you have really critical latency needs. It is not something you want to have enabled for every type of workload, but if you have workloads that are very latency sensitive, you may want to investigate this setting. Essentially, what this does is the way inbound processing typically works is the OSA receives the data from the network, then it sends an interrupt to the operating system. Now, as you know, the interrupt, what that interrupt processing needs to do is it basically needs to interrupt the operating system. The operating system has to dispatch a unit of work to handle that interrupt, and then that unit of work will then eventually go and get data. So what happens without OLM enabled, the OSA does the interrupt. Then at that point, before it does the interrupt, what the OSA does is it reads all the data off the network, stores it into the ZOS memory, and then schedules the interrupt. So that we have the data already in place before we even schedule the interrupt. What optimized latency mode does is we do actually something called early interrupts. Rather than move all the data in and then schedule the interrupt, and then by the time you have latency built in by the time the unit of work gets dispatched to handle that interrupt, what we do here is we'll actually do the OSA does the interrupt first and then starts copying the data, with the goal being by the time that interrupt, the unit of work is dispatched to handle that interrupt, OSA has already moved the data over. So that way we reduce latency in being able to dispatch that unit of work to handle an interrupt. There may be some cases where by the unit of work to handle that interrupt gets dispatched before all the data gets copied over. In that case, that unit of work will have to spin temporarily until the data is ready. In our performance measurements we see here, we very seldom, if ever, see any needing for spinning. Usually by the time that dispatchable unit is running to handle that interrupt, the data is already there. So that is one optimization we've done to reduce latency on the inbound side for optimized latency mode. The other thing we did is on the outbound case, the way we signal the OSA express that it's ready to send, that it's okay to send data, is we do this SIGA instruction, it's called, SIGA. Essentially what that does is we basically notify the OSA that there's data to be read and sent out onto the network. We do that. So if we have a set of data that's coming in and we are coming down from applications, and we'll do a SIG-A to tell the OSA Express, here's data. Now another batch of data comes down from other applications or the same application, we'll then have to do another SIG-A to basically tell the OSA, oh, here's more data. Those SIG-As can be a little expensive. So what we do with the optimized latency mode is we do something called SIG-A reduction. So rather than having to issue the SIG-A for every batch of data we get from an application, from applications, what we'll do instead is if the batch of data arrives with us at a quick enough time since the last time we did a SIG-A, rather than do another SIG-A, we basically queue it up in a place where the OSA will look after it's finished processing its prior data. And if there's any data there, then the OSA can immediately read that data and put it out on the network without having to get a SIG-A to basically be alerted that there's data there. As I mentioned, this basically reduces latency on both the inbound and outbound side, but there may be some additional CPU overhead because of the spinning that's happening. So it really is only for these workloads that you have critical latency needs for. But what makes this nice is that prior to V1R12, when we had inbound workload queuing, if you had mixed workloads, you do not want to enable OLM for streaming workloads, because the increased number of interrupts, because we are interrupting on every packet with OLM, it would be the CPU cost would be extremely high for streaming workloads. But now with V1R12, where we can move that streaming workload onto its own queue, the optimized latency mode starts to make more sense for our interactive traffic, because we know that the only thing on that default queue will be interactive traffic. So then optimized latency mode makes more sense to enable in that case. So how do you enable it? It's basically, again, on the interface statement, like the inbound workload queuing keyword, it is not on the device link, only the interface statement. And you can use the netstat dev link command to see the setting, whether opti latency mode is set to yes or no. The default is no. So any questions on that before I go into just some performance data on some of this inbound tuning that our different options we have for inbound tuning? All right, so going into performance data, before we jump into this, I just want to, just a caveat here, the workloads that we generate here, there is no application logic involved. It's basically the application reads the data and sends out the data. It does no DASD IO. It doesn't do any database things. It doesn't do any business logic. So the reason behind that is because we really want to focus directly on the networking performance. So in some of these charts, if you see, say a 40% reduction in networking cost, you got to take that kind of with a grain of salt, because typical workloads, networking costs may account for between, say, like 10 to 30% of the overall cost of a workload. So if you're seeing something that's 40% reduction in networking cost, that really would translate, for example, if you have a workload that uses 10% of its networking overhead, that would actually translate into about a 4% reduction. So just when you see these numbers, don't assume that your workload is going to see these reductions. It really is just we're focusing solely on networking costs. Networking costs are doing the device layer processing of either passing data to the OSA or handling interrupts for the OSA, going up to the TCP/IP stack, going to Unix system services in order to actually communicate with the application that's sending and receiving data, and, typical MVS processing for dispatching units of work, that kind of stuff. But that's really what we're measuring here, is just that networking cost. So with that in mind, on slide 24, just enabling dynamic LAN idle timer. This is for interactive work. This is if you know your interface is only handling mainly interactive work and only periodically there may be streaming workload, with dynamic LAN idle versus balance, what you'll see for a single request response workload, we were able to improve our transaction rate by 50% and reduce our response time by a third. Now, as you add more sessions, we were able to even get in better improvements as well. So because we the balance mode, we are interrupting less frequently, so we actually are incurring a delay on every packet coming in. By eliminating that with dynamically and idle, we get interrupted more frequently or more quickly, which means that we'll able to turn around the request and send a response back a lot quicker, which will boost our transaction rate. So in this scenario here, the request response workload was basically we got a 100-byte request in, and we generated an 800-byte response and sent it back out. So as you can see, just by enabling dynamic lay and idle for your interactive workloads versus balance, you see a significant improvement both in transaction rate and response time. For inbound workload queuing, what we had here is we actually had a mixed workload. We had 30 request response sessions and a single streaming session that was occurring at the exact same time. As you can see, with dynamic, when we enabled IWQ, which basically put all of that streaming workload on its own queue, it made the RR workload dramatically better. The reason behind that is because now that dynamic keyword, it allowed us to set our dynamic LAN idle timer a lot lower because all we had on that default queue was interactive traffic. So you can see our request response workload improved by about 55%. You'll also see, because it was on its own queue, you'll actually see what may seem to be a surprise is that the streaming workload also improved a little bit, about 5%. The reason behind this is when I talked about this earlier, because it's on its own queue, we now can force it all to be run under a single SRB, which means that we can guarantee in-order delivery of the packets. So by now, so in this scenario here, we were actually getting out-of-order packets without IWQ happening. So when we were able to put it on its own queue and eliminate that, we were actually able to see a 5% throughput boost just because of that. Now, I'm giving a better example of this. This is just pure streaming, either going from ZOS to AIX or ZOS to ZOS. By going to IWQ, we were able to eliminate a lot of out-of-order problems that were happening on both platforms, and you were able to see that we were improved throughput anywhere from 40% for the ZOS to AIX, and from ZOS to ZOS, again, we were improved about 24%. And just to reiterate what I said before, when we're talking streaming, you know, a 40% throughput improvement, this is based on pure networking. We're not storing the data anywhere in DASD. Obviously, if you're doing your true FTP and you're actually writing and reading from DASD, your throughput improvement will not be 40%. You'll see some improvement, but, there'll definitely be an improvement, but some of it will be hidden due to the DASD I/O. All right, on slide 27, this is kind of a little busy one, but I wanted to try to show you what if you knew you had just purely interactive traffic and you had demanding latency needs, by enabling optimized latency mode, you'll actually see on the top chart is latency or response time, and obviously the lower the number, the better, which means our shorter response time. You will see when we enable OLM, our response time goes down across all different types of number of simultaneous sessions, interactive sessions. Similarly, you'll see on the bottom chart, our transaction rate improves with every type of workload we ran at put at it as well. So again, there will be a slight CPU increase because we are interrupting more frequently, but we are actually being able to reduce our latency substantially. All right, finally, what we've done is we have a mixed workload, and as I mentioned before, prior to IWQ, you probably did not want to enable OLM because if you have any type of streaming workload going in over that interface, you will have substantially a higher CPU issue. So now, though, with IWQ, where we can move that workload onto its own queue, the streaming workover onto its own queue, you'll actually see the benefits. So you first, the green line there is for balance mode, and then just turning on dynamic mode, you'll actually see somewhat of an improvement. When we turn on IWQ, you see an IWQ with OLM, you will actually see quite a big boost in transaction rate for the request response workload. You will also see in this scenario here a reduction in the streaming workload. Now, the reason for the reduction in the streaming workload, it has nothing to do with because of IWQ. It actually turned out in this case we were reaching capacity on our OSA at this point. So the streaming workload basically was getting capped due to the capacity of the OSA, not due to anything else. So that if we weren't capped on the OSA, you would see those two numbers at least be the same as dynamic or probably would be a little bit better as well. Okay, so I'm going to skip through some of this. This is more for your reading, for later reading. But basically, there are some requirements in terms or considerations. There's certain levels of drivers and stuff that we recommend. These may not be the current field level, but these are the field levels that we had done our testing with, and that should be available. Anything above it would be fine as well. So I'm going to skip through some of these considerations more for you to view afterwards. If you have any questions or whatever on these afterwards, let me know. I just want to get into the other stuff before we run out of our time.
Hey, Matt, can you state the slide number?
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, for the considerations, it's slide 30, 31, and 32 were the considerations. And, again, I talked about, you know, the specific microcode levels you need, talking a little bit about, you know, OLM increases CPU usage and certain PTFs that you'll need to enable if you're back on a V1R11 release. It's in the base for V1R12. So going to slide 33 then, we've talked a lot about inbound optimizations. What I want to talk about now in the next few 10 minutes or so is some of our outbound optimization we've done. The first one I want to talk about is segmentation offload. Some of you may be aware of this, and some of you may be aware of the history of this. There was some issues with this when it was first released. Basically, there was issues with the NIC that resides on the OSA card, and so at this point, for the past several years, everything has been addressed, and we have a lot of customers that are running with this, and there has been no issues surfaced for the past several years on this. So to us, it's considered safe to be able to enable again. What segmentation offload is, it's really geared toward when you're sending large amounts of data outbound out of ZOS. So today, suppose you send an application sends 64K worth of data out. That 64K doesn't arrive on the OSA in one segment and get sent out as one large segment out on the network. Because of MTU considerations, typically the MTU is 1,500, that 64K buffer actually has to get carved up into about 45 different 1,500 byte packets, which means that from ZOS we have to take that 64K buffer, carve it up into 45 different packets, put an IP header and a TCP header on each one of those, and then send all those packets to the OSA, and then the OSA has to basically send all those different individual packets out. So doing the segmentation is expensive on the host side. So what segmentation offload does, it allows ZOS to send that 164K buffer or any size buffer, large chunk, directly to the OSA. Now what the OSA will do is it will actually do the segmentation itself. So now rather than having to spend cycles on ZOS carving up the packets as well as putting IP headers and doing TCP headers on every one of these packets, that's all being done on the OSA. Slide 35, what you'll see is by enabling segmentation offload on both the OSA Express 3 and the OSA Express 4, you see substantial CPU reduction. And in the case of OSA Express 4, you will actually see a little bit of a throughput improvement, and the reason behind that is the OSA Express 4 has a faster processor than the OSA Express 3, so it actually can do the segmentation a lot more efficiently. So you'll actually get a little bit of a throughput boost as well. So obviously, this is a good story, and like I mentioned, there's been a lot of history behind segmentation offload, but at this point, it is considered safe to enable.
Question.
Yes.
Does this imply then that the larger the send buffer size the application using, the better, i.e. it takes more advantage of segmentation offload?
That is correct. And in this scenario here, this was an FTP transfer, and FTP uses 180K buffer size. So yes, as you increase the size of your send buffer, you will actually see better benefits.
Okay, so we should be looking for applications to up it as high as they can. So they do one write operation, and then we segment it from there.
Yes.
Okay.
How is segmentation offload enabled? It is a global config statement. The default is no segmentation offload, or you can set it to segmentation offload. Basically, what that does then is any time that we send a certain size packet, rather than doing the segmentation ourselves, we'll actually send it down and have the OSA send it off. There are some scenarios where segmentation offload will not occur, even if you have it enabled. One scenario is when packets go LPAR to LPAR across a shared OSA, that segmentation offload code is actually the segmentation processing in the OSA is actually occurring on the NIC that's built into the OSA card. When we go LPAR to LPAR sharing an OSA, the OSA never goes through the NIC, so we'll never be able to do segmentation for those kind of packets. But TCP/IP detects that, and it will do the segmentation itself. Obviously, IPsec, you can't do it because we need to build and encrypt each individual packet before sending it down to the OSA. OSA only would do the segmentation and doesn't know how to do IPsec encryption or anything. And the final scenario is if you have multipath in effect, and some of your interfaces for that allow segmentation offload and others don't, we'll default it to turn off segmentation offload for the entire multipath group. All right. The other
question.
Yeah, sure.
How is a packet retransmit handled in that scenario?
Yeah, how does packet retransmit? With segmentation offload, we send the entire packet down, and then the OSA segments it out. But each one of those segments gets acknowledged just like it would be if segmentation was occurring in the stack. And each one of those acknowledgments flows back up to the TCP/IP stack that originated the packet. If we lose a packet, we'll detect that, and we'll only send the one segment from the TCP layer. The OSA does not do the retransmits or anything like that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, the other thing that I wanted to talk about is OSA Express outbound priority queuing. OSA has four queues built into it. These are not, don't get confused with the inbound queues that we're talking about before. These are outbound queues, and OSA has always had four of these queues. The way OSA works is any packets that are queued on Q1 get sent out before OSA handles packets on Q2 and so on and so forth. So Q4 is the lowest priority. So nothing gets sent out on Q4 until Q1, 2, and 3 are empty. We do have the ability through Policy Agent, you can create QoS policies to basically map TOS settings so that we could actually queue the different outbound traffic to the different queues. This has not been widely exploited by customers. It's not that intuitive to use, and so what we try to do is figure out a way how can we simplify being able to use these multiple queues on the OSAs. The way we did it is using WLM. WLM, as you're all probably familiar with, today manages resources. So you could have two different types of workloads at two different importance level, and what happens is when resources get overcommitted, WLM prioritizes. So if you start losing having CPU resource issues, WLM will make sure that the CPUs are available for the higher important work and basically deprives the lower importance work because it is defined as being lower importance. Similar with any type of memory, WLM have now being able to handle doing I/O priorities. For example, doing writes to DASD or tape, the applications or workloads that have the higher importance level get priority over the lower importance and being able to do I/O. So we thought about, well, what can we do about network I/O priority? So essentially, if you have Pageant, we'll continue to use it. This is on slide 39. But if you do not use Pageant, if you set the WLM priority queue keyword in the TCP profile, what we'll do now is we'll actually look at the importance level of that application sending data, and we will map it to one of those queues. And the way this mapping is done is on slide 40. So in this scenario here, what we said was SysSTC, which is system and SysSTC are typically the highest service classes in WLM. In our scenario here, we assign them to Q1. By saying IO priority 1, we said SysTCPC is 0. And then what we said is for user-defined importance level of 1, we assign to Q2 in the OSA. User-defined importance level 2 and 3, we assign to Q3. And the other two, we assign to Q4, as well as discretionary work, we assign to the last queue as well. And you'll see there's something called FWD, that's forwarded traffic. Since we in this scenario here, we classified forwarded traffic as being low priority, and we put it in Q4 as well. So what this means then is that anything that any application that's operating at the SysSTC level is going to have higher priority over anything else to any other applications that are defined at other different user-defined importance levels. Okay, we only got a couple more slides here, but we have run out of time. But let me quickly go through these other slides then. Basically, what I wanted to show you is what, first of all, with our performance measurements, what does WLM outbound priority queuing give us? So what I have here is I have a mix of request response and streaming workload. I made the request response workload an importance level of 2, which was higher than the streaming workload, which is an importance level of 3. So as you can see, the transaction rate improves for the request response workload because it's at a higher priority at the expense of the streaming workload. It's more pronounced with the latency when you see the streaming workloads have a little higher latency than an increase in latency, but again, it's because they are lower priority work. These will be even more pronounced. We were not, in these measurements, we were not close to make being bottlenecked on the OSA. We weren't reaching 100% utilization of the OSA. As you get closer to reaching 100% utilization of the OSA, you would actually see these numbers improve even more because you would really start seeing us favor the higher priority work over the other work, and the other work would be at a disadvantage, but it is lower priority work. Okay. So how do we determine which priority queues are being used? Well, you need to find your TRLE and that for the OSA that you've defined, and then you display the TRLE. And in this case here, you'll actually see right now in this display, the only queue we were using was priority Q1. And we currently had 25 packets in there, and we averaged about 51 packets at a time in there. That's what basically that command is showing. On slide 43, we also have a VTAM tuning stats display, and it will actually tell you the different queues, how many bytes we sent out on each of the queues. So prior to WLM queuing, pretty much we always send everything to Q4, where with WLM priority queuing, you'll actually see the traffic is split among the different queues depending on the priority of those applications sending the data. Finally, I just want to touch on OSA Express 4. OSA Express 4 is available on the GA2 version of the Z196, and we have improved on-card processor speed and memory bus. So what actually that shows is for 10 gigabit, even though we were never able to really achieve close to full utilization of the OSA Express 3 10 gig, and that was mainly due to the processor speed of the OSA. For OSA 4, you can see just by going to OSA 4, we've improved, things have improved with the OSA 4 in terms of speed that we're actually able to get quite a bit of a throughput boost without doing anything else other than just changing the card. Now, the other things that OSA Express 4 give us is for IPv6 traffic, we've never had checksum offload or segmentation offload support. With OSA Express 4, now that is available as well. So you would see actually, this is for IPv4 traffic, the throughput improvement. You would actually see if a CPU reduction in well if you do IPv6 traffic, because we're now able to do checksum offload of the IPv6 packets where before we'd always have to do that checksum for IPv6 packets directly in TCP/IP. So initial measurements of OSI Express 4 show a good story. And we will be updating this presentation with additional OSI Express 4 measurements. There are some additional stuff that the OSI Express 4 supports that we have not really measured or published yet. Finally, all of these, a lot of these performance summaries, every release communication server generates a report, and we publish it out on the web, and here's a link to it. But a lot of stuff we do is we'll actually do specific performance of line items that were geared towards performance for the release. We always do a release-to-release comparison to show that we've made improvements or at least held the line with a lot of these different workloads. And we do capacity planning information for Telnet, FTP, and KickSocket, both with and without security. And we show like CSM usage and DTAM buffer usage for these different types of workloads as well. So in this case right here, on the website here, it's an older snapshot, but we have the V1R2 summary. We also now have the V1R13 summary. You'll also see this OSI Express 3 inbound workload queuing white paper. A lot of this presentation was extracted from that white paper, so if you want a little bit more words behind this presentation, you can also go and read that white paper as well. If not, thank you very much for your time this morning. I hope this was useful for you.
Well, thank you, Mike.